We now have Juliet Shaw in 2009 speaking to Harvard Law School. This talk is entitled Colossal Failure, the Output Bias of Market Economies.
We started this morning with the financial collapse and the role of free market ideology in getting us to where we are today, the failure of economists and other true believers in the market to anticipate what would happen. And to see the ways in which the system was throwing up, you know, what we now know are fictitious results, that is, you know, hundreds of billions in fictitious profits for years before the crash. I think there's a similar, although far more dangerous, and of course what we're going through is, you know, quite dangerous, and far-reaching situation which is developing with respect to the planetary, regional, and local ecosystems that, to the Earth. Which is the running down of stocks of natural capital and undermining the basic functionings of the Earth. And I also fear that we have a similar kind of blindness among economists. Shiller called it a groupthink, about how the market and our economic system is influencing the natural world. Economists aren't listening to the scientists. A few are starting to more, and there's a little bit more conversation and listening going on with respect to climate change than there is to other kinds of ecological degradation. But that disconnect between the science and the economics, I think, is something that really ought to concern us. And that's what I want to talk about today. And in particular, what I'm going to argue, and this is what I call the colossal failure, is that there are a number of ways in which a market economy has a bias toward the production of output, and the flip side of which is income, and over time that means a trajectory of growth, rather than alternative uses of productivity, growth, and activity. And that we tend not to see this bias, but it's very large. It operates in the goods markets, I'm going to argue, and in labor markets. Those are two very, very big markets. Goods, by which I mean goods and services, that consumer markets in general, and in labor markets. The point about the economists, I think, on this, or economics as a field on this, and someone mentioned earlier the concept of the magic of the market, and Reagan talking about the magic of the market. There is, of course, that cornucopian position. It's a small position within economics, the kind of cornucopian fantasies that say, oh, the more growth, the more population, better. There is no such thing as limits. The Earth is effectively unlimited because human ingenuity, fueled by greater population, will solve all natural limits, and we'll create, out of the brilliance of our mind, substitutes for nature. And so don't ever worry about natural limits, because we can substitute for nature, ingenuity for nature. That's a sort of extreme point of view, which also tends to have a fairly strong politics to it, but I think much more significant is the kind of, you know, more mainstream position on this, which comes, kind of encapsulated probably in the notion of the environmental Kuznets curve. For those of you who've, you know, studied in economics, you know the Kuznets curve posits this trade-off between equality and income, or equality and growth, and if you want to grow, you have to give up equality, and eventually you'll get your equality back, because equality is a normal good, and as people get richer, societies get richer, they're going to want more equality, so they're going to redistribute from the market. And you've got the same argument with respect to the environment. It says, well, if you want growth, you've got to ravage your environment, but not to worry. Eventually, you'll get rich enough that you're going to want to buy more environment, because environment is a normal good, or maybe even a luxury good. And so growth will solve your environmental problem. It's the kind of argument that sometimes when you talk to people outside of economic circles, it sounds like a Monty Python skit. You know, but of course within the discipline, it's exactly the kind of logic that's at work and had very, very little criticism. Of course, it turns out the evidence is absolutely not there for it at all, particularly with the really big ecological problems. You've got it happened. You see some evidence for it with a. But in a consumption in a world in which you allow interdependence of preferences, you have a lot of norm-driven and competitive kinds of consumption. And in particular, the more inequality you get, the more of this type of consumption competition you tend to have. Veblen, of course, famously wrote about it, thinking about status competition. But even if we're not talking about status goods, let's say we're just talking about a basic process of keeping up with a rising norm. If you have an economic driver, say income, coming into your system as from the process I was just talking to you about, you'll have this upscaling of norms so that income is going to get spent. And what happens is you have a continual upscaling, no positional, you can have a model in which you have no positional change, so everybody's just as well off positionally as they were before, but when the norm is moving up, everybody has to keep up. Now, as it turns out, if you look at what's happened in the United States over the last couple of decades, people have kept up by working longer hours, by going into debt, by doing a lot of things that have then undermined well-being, eroded community, and had adverse effects on well-being because they're in that positional treadmill. Think about what the positional treadmill means from the point of view of the environment. It means that we are producing more and more and more, doing more and more ecological degradation just because we're on a positional treadmill. I mean, from a social point of view, it's deeply irrational, even though it's rational from the point of view of the individual. Classic example of a, kind of prisoner's dilemma market failure. But it's absolutely endemic. And the more you have a social model of consumption, the more pronounced this effect becomes. And what I would argue is in the contemporary period in which we have shifted to a very symbolically driven consumer society, and of course there's been tons written about that and what it means, it means that you get these competitions. And I'm just going to show you the way one of them has been working, and this is in apparel markets. Just been charting. This is not a status model so much as just a fast accumulation model. But what happens is when the social life of a good declines, so that's a norm upscaling, okay, so that the fashionability window shrinks, so you get to a kind of extreme or a fast fashion system, people begin accumulating and churning goods at more and more rapid rates, and that competition just keeps it going. So the average American went from, in 1991, purchasing about 33 pieces of new apparel per year up to, we're just about up at 70 by 2005. And lest you want to make a standard neoclassical argument that says, well, this is fine, it's giving people lots of well-being, look at what they've been doing with it. Churning it right out, buying and discarding. So we're in a rapid cycle of accumulation and discard, which is sort of the, it's like at the end of a boom. And I'm going to skip over the two slides that tell you about how it's happening in so many other goods, in furniture and glassware and sporting goods and et cetera, et cetera. So it's happening throughout the durable goods sector. Cell phones, another perfect example. Okay, let me conclude. Market outcomes can be profoundly dysfunctional, and I have identified two major markets, labor markets and goods markets, in which I would argue outcomes are dysfunctional, not because of small externalities, but because of basic features which have characterized the system since its inception. Second is relations between firms and employees, and that's that story of the labor market, relations among people in societies with inequality and discretionary consumption. I do want to say one thing, though, which is that it's not just about the market. And it may not be even in some ways primarily about the market. I think we have had a tendency to kind of, we're just talking, because this debate historically has been about market versus states, markets v. states, we've really, those are the categories that we've focused on. But I think to understand many of the problems of a quote-unquote free market mindset or free market system, you have to look at the underlying property distribution, because different property distributions yield different kinds of market outcomes for reasons that have to do with the embeddedness of people and culture. And, I mean, it's a longer story about why, but it's a really important point. It's not just about market exchange. Maybe it, you want to think of the market much more broadly, or a capitalist market with high levels of inequality in distributions of property. But a lot of the problems that have developed in our economy have to do with the distributions of wealth and income and the growing skewness in those, embedded in then a market. So it's not just the market. It's the market interacting with a particular distribution of property. And remember, these models of the market are all about lots of little agents, you know, all of whom are property holders. I mean, the property distributions are, or none of whom are, or it's completely unspecified, because it's not a category in the model, but it's really central to understanding it. If we want to solve the ecological problem, we've got to restructure control of nature. I don't want to talk about ownership. I don't believe in ownership of nature. If we were just talking about another economic asset, it would be. We need to think about labor markets and also property distributions to do something about this, you know, very fundamental output bias in the way the system works. Thank you. The market economy overproduces and overgrows. This is both in any common sense notion of the word, in relationship to the ecological system, and even on its own terms, the pure terms of the model. So it is exceeding an optimal level of, on the one hand, I'm going to show you output growth through labor market dynamics and also through dynamics in the goods market. So output bias in the labor market, too many hours of work, too little translation of productivity gains into leisure, output bias in the goods market, consumption competitions leading to excessive consumption of status goods relative to human well-being and planetary health.
There is a question and answer section following that speech by Juliet Shaw, but I had to cut it on grounds of time. In any case, encouraging that she reaches similar to conclusions to so many of our other speakers, although she is arguing using classical economic logic. A status good is something that people consume in order to show their relative status in a group. And a classic example is cosmetics, and that's what we're going to be looking at now. This is the soundtrack to a 2010 animated short film by Annie Leonard, The Story of Cosmetics.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. Can I tell you, I love my Pantene Pro-V. Of the dozen or so personal care products that I use every day, it's the one I can't live without. Says it gives my dull hair the ultimate cool shine. How does it do that? I was wondering that while I was lathering it in my hair one day, so I read the ingredients right here. Sodium lauryl sulfate, tetrasodium EDTA, methyl isothiazolinone. What is this stuff? I took this list to some scientists who know how to read it. Turns out my Pantene contains a chemical linked to cancer. And lots of other products in my bathroom, from sunscreen to lipstick and even baby shampoo, also contain chemicals linked to cancer or other problems like learning disabilities, asthma, and even damaged sperm. Like most parents, I try to keep my family safe. But now I find out my bathroom is a minefield of toxins? What are we supposed to do? To find out the answers, we have to go back to one of the key features of our materials economy: toxics in, toxics out. If, at the factory, you pour toxic chemicals into a product, like baby shampoo, you're going to wind up with toxic baby shampoo. And toxics in workers, communities, and, babies. So let's take a closer look at this toxic outrage where it seeps into our lives every day, in the bathroom. The average woman in the U.S. uses about 12 personal care products daily. The average man, about 6. Each product containing a dozen or more chemicals. Less than 20% of chemicals in cosmetics have been assessed for safety by the industry's safety panel, so we just don't know what they do to us when we use them. Would you fly on an airline that only inspects 20% of its planes? Of course, not all of these chemicals are dangerous, but we know that many are. Some are carcinogens. That means that they can cause cancer. Others are neurotoxins and reproductive toxins, proven to mess up brain development and reproduction in animals. Wait a minute. We're animals, too. It's like a giant experiment. We're using all these mystery chemicals and just waiting to see what happens. One thing we do know is that they're getting inside us. I had my body's toxicity levels tested, and I'm loaded with things like mercury, flame retardants, triclosan, and lead. We all are. Even babies are being born pre-polluted. Now, I know we can't live in a lead-free world, but do we have to put lead in our lipstick? I don't know. Maybe it's my fault. Maybe I just bought the wrong thing. At the store, the choices seem endless. I can get lipstick in 49 shades, or shampoo for hair that's too dry, oily, fine, limp, or frizzy. But what about the choices that really matter, like the choice to buy products that are safe? It turns out the important decisions don't happen when I choose to take a product off the shelf. They happen when companies and governments decide what products should go on the shelves. So who are these companies? This is Procter & Gamble. They're the ones offering me Herbal Essences, the number 2 shampoo in the country. It contains toxic petrochemicals made from oil. Since when is oil an herb? On cosmetics labels, words like herbal, natural, even organic have no legal definition. That means that anybody can put anything in a bottle and call it natural, and they do. I mean, can you imagine a top seller called Petro Essences? Gross. What's even nastier are hair relaxers marketed to 5-year-olds and skin whitening creams. These are super toxic, both in their ingredients and in the message they send about what beauty is. Ooh, here's Estee Lauder offering me a chance to help find a cure for breast cancer. That's nice. But wait, they're also using chemicals linked to cancer. Don't you think the best way for Estee Lauder to fight cancer is to stop using those chemicals in the first place? So really, I get to choose between meaningless claims on a bottle. But these guys get the real choice about what goes into those bottles. And that happens back here, at the factories where they're formulated. Why do the makers of these products use all these toxics? Are they trying to poison us? No, they're just working from a 1950s mindset when people were totally swept up in better living through chemistry. In all that excitement, they forgot to worry about human health impacts. That was years ago, and they are still using these same old toxic chemicals. Today, big cosmetics companies say the doses of poison in their products are small enough to be harmless. Yeah, maybe if you use them once a year. I guess they never get out and see that their products are being used and combined with other products every day. A little toxic dose under your arms, a little more on your hair, on your lips. And workers in nail and hair salons get dosed all day long. So the industry is used to doing things this way. And they can. Because even now that scientists have linked the chemicals they're using to all sorts of problems, there are no laws to get rid of them. You're thinking, really? Come on, nobody's making sure that the stuff we smear all over our bodies is safe? Nope. The FDA doesn't even assess the safety of personal care products or their ingredients. Since 1938, they've banned just 8 out of over 12,000 ingredients used in cosmetics. They don't even require that all of the ingredients be listed on the label. Now, this is an example where we can all agree a little more government action would be helpful. This lack of regulation leaves a huge hole that the cosmetics industry is all too happy to fill. They set up their own committee to self-police their products, and compliance with their recommendations is voluntary. So the cosmetics industry is making the rules and then deciding whether or not to follow them. So you see, it isn't our fault that these toxic products are in our bathrooms. It's a whole broken system that's ignoring the simple rule, toxics in, toxics out. But we're not helpless. There are resources online that we can use to protect ourselves by identifying the best possible choices in the store. But the real action is with people working to change the system. Because if we really want to solve this problem, we got to start here with these guys. Women, parents, workers, people all over the country are demanding that Congress pass a new law, giving FDA the power to make sure that our personal care products are safe. We need common sense laws based on the precautionary principle. That means that when you're dealing with hazardous chemicals, just err on the side of caution. Let's not debate how much lead should be allowed in lipstick. Just get the toxic chemicals out of our products. Smarter laws would force companies to get past that old 50s mindset and figure out how to get us all clean and shiny without toxic chemicals. Can they? Totally. Many responsible cosmetics companies are already putting safer products on the market. Green chemists are developing substances that are designed to be safe and non-toxic in the first place. European governments have required the removal of many toxic chemicals, and companies have figured out how to comply. When cosmetics are reformulated to be safe and labeled honestly, then we can feel comfortable with the choices available at the store. We can choose bouncy hair or full hair, shiny lipstick or matte. We can even choose to feel beautiful without using 20 products. But we'll know that whatever we choose, the most important choice, the choice to be safe and healthy, has already been made.
That was The Story of Cosmetics from 2010. Now let's hear the one that started it all. This has been pretty successful. This has been seen over 12 million times. Although the soundtrack is a coherent listen, it's clearer still if you watch it, and I've used it for teaching non-native speaking teenagers, and it's worked very well. They like the animated figures, so although it's not as academic and as out of the box as most of the stuff, it's highly recommended, perhaps the sort of thing you might be able to share with neighbours. This is Annie Leonard from 2007. This is The Story of Stuff.
Do you have one of these? I got a little obsessed with mine. In fact, I got a little obsessed with all my stuff. Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out? That is not the whole story. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine. No problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system, and we live on a finite planet. And you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. So let's go back through. Let's fill in some of the blanks and see what's missing. Well, one of the most important things that's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values the government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. Okay, so let's see what else is missing from this picture. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past three decades alone, one-third of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at U.S. rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world, which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. So next, the materials move to production. And what happens there is we use energy to mix toxic chemicals in with the natural resources to make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts, and none have been tested for synergistic health impacts. That means when they interact with all the other chemicals we're exposed to every day. So we don't know the full impact on health and the environment of all these toxic chemicals, but we do know one thing. Toxics in, toxics out. As long as we keep putting toxics into our industrial production systems, we're going to keep getting toxics in the stuff that we bring into our homes and workplaces and schools. And duh, our bodies. Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night. Now, these toxics build up the food chain and concentrate in our bodies. Do you know what is the food at the top of the food chain with the highest level of many toxic contaminants? Human breast milk. That means that we've reached a point where the smallest members of our societies, our babies, are getting the highest lifetime dose of toxic chemicals from breastfeeding from their mothers. Is that not an incredible violation? Breastfeeding must be the most fundamental human act of nurturing. It should be sacred and safe. Now, breastfeeding is still best, and mothers should definitely keep breastfeeding, but we should protect it. They should protect it. I thought they were looking out for us. And of course, the people who bear the biggest brunt of these toxic chemicals are the factory workers, many of whom are women of reproductive age. They're working with reproductive toxins, carcinogens, and more. Now I ask you, what kind of woman of reproductive age would work in a job exposed to reproductive toxins except for a woman with no other option? And that's one of the beauties of this system. The erosion of local environments and economies here ensures a constant supply of people with no other option. Globally, 200,000 people a day are moving from environments that have sustained them for generations into cities, many to live in slums, looking for work, no matter how toxic that work may be. So you see, it's not just resources that are wasted along this system, but people too. Whole communities get wasted. Yep, toxics in, toxics out. A lot of the toxics leave the factories in products, but even more leave as byproducts or pollution. And it's a lot of pollution. In the U.S., our industry admits to releasing over 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year. And it's probably a lot more, because that's only what they admit. So that's another limit, because yuck, who wants to look at and smell 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year? So what do? Move the dirty factories overseas. Pollute someone else's land. But surprise, a lot of that pollution is coming right back at us, carried by wind currents. So what happens after all these natural resources are turned into products? Well, it moves here for distribution. Now, distribution means selling all the toxic contaminated junk as quickly as possible. The goal here is to keep the prices down, keep the people buying, and keep the inventory moving. How do they keep the prices down? Well, they don't pay the store workers very much, and they skimp on health insurance every time they can. It's all about externalizing the costs. What that means is that the real costs of making stuff aren't captured in the price. In other words, we aren't paying for the stuff we buy. I was thinking about this the other day. I was walking to work and I wanted to listen to the news, so I popped into a Radio Shack to buy a radio. I found this cute little green radio for $4.99. I was standing there in line to buy this thing and I was thinking, how could $4.99 possibly capture the cost of making this radio and getting it into my hands? The metal was probably mined in South Africa. The petroleum was probably drilled in Iraq. The plastics were probably produced in China, and maybe the whole thing was assembled by some 15-year-old in a maquiladora in Mexico. $4.99 wouldn't even pay the rent for the shelf space it occupied until I came along, let alone part of the staff guy's salary who helped me pick it out, or the multiple ocean cruises and truck rides pieces of this radio went on. That's how I realized I didn't pay for the radio. So who did pay? Well, these people paid with the loss of their natural resource space. These people paid with the loss of their clean air, with increasing asthma and cancer rates. Kids in the Congo paid with their future. 30% of the kids in the Congo now have dropped out of school to mine coltan, a metal we need for our cheap and disposable electronics. These people even paid by having to cover their own health insurance. All along this system, people pitched in so I could get this radio for $4.99. And none of these contributions are recorded in any accounts book. That's what I mean by the company owners externalize the true cost of production. And that brings us to the golden arrow of consumption. This is the heart of the system, the engine that drives it. It is so important that protecting this arrow has become the top priority for both of these guys. That's why after 9/11, when our country was in shock and President Bush could have suggested any number of appropriate things, to grieve, to pray, to hope, no, he said to shop, to shop. We have become a nation of consumers. Our primary identity has become that of being consumers, not mothers, teachers, farmers, but consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop. Keep the materials flowing. And flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. Now, how can we run a planet with that level of materials throughput? It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues, even everything. Even computers. Have you noticed that when you buy a computer now, the technology is changing so fast that in just a couple of years, it's actually an impediment to communication? I was curious about this, so I opened up a big desktop computer to see what was inside. And I found out that the piece that changes each year is just a tiny little piece in the corner. But you can't just change that one piece because each new version is a different shape. So you gotta chuck the whole thing and buy a new one. So I was reading industrial design journals from the 1950s when planned obsolescence was really catching on. These designers are so open about it. They actually discuss how fast can they make stuff break that still leaves the consumer having enough faith in the product to go out and buy another one. It was so intentional. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Like, I've had the same fat white computer monitor on my desk for 5 years. My coworker just got a new computer. She has a flat, shiny, sleek monitor. It matches her computer, it matches her phone, even her pen stand. She looks like she's driving in Spaceship Central, and I look like I've got a washing machine on my desk. Fashion is another prime example of this. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes. Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping. Media also helps by hiding all of this and all of this. So the only part of the materials economy we see is the shopping. The extraction, production, and disposal all happens outside of our field of vision. So in the U.S., we have more stuff than ever before. But polls show that our national happiness is actually declining. Our national happiness peaked in the 1950s, the same time that this consumption mania exploded. Interesting coincidence. I think I know why. We have more stuff, but we have less time for the things that really make us happy. Friends, family, leisure time. We're working harder than ever. Some analysts say we have less leisure time than any time since feudal society. And do you know what the two main activities are that we do with the scant leisure time we have? Watch TV and shop. In the U.S., we spend 3 to 4 times as many hours shopping as our counterparts in Europe do. So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe 2 jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted, so we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us you suck, so you gotta go to the mall to buy something to feel better, and then you gotta go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought, so you come home and you're more tired, so you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again, and we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill, and we could just stop. So in the end, what happens to all the stuff we buy anyway? At this rate of consumption, it can't fit into our houses, even though the average house size has doubled in this country since the 1970s. It all goes out in the garbage. And that brings us to disposal. This is the part of the materials economy we all know the most because we have to haul the junk out to the curb ourselves. Each of us in the United States makes 4.5 pounds of garbage a day. That's twice what we each made 30 years ago. All of this garbage either gets dumped in a landfill, which is just a big hole in the ground, or if you're really unlucky, first it's burned in an incinerator and then dumped in the landfill. Either way, they both pollute the air, land, water, and don't forget, change the climate. Incineration is really bad. Remember those toxics back in the production stage? Well, burning the garbage releases the toxics up into the air. Even worse, it makes new super toxics, like dioxin. Dioxin is the most toxic man-made substance known to science, and incinerators are the number one toxin. That means that we could stop the number one source of the most toxic man-made substance known just by stopping burning the trash. We could stop it today. Now, some companies don't want to deal with building landfills and incinerators here, so they just export the disposal, too. What about recycling? Does recycling help? Yes, recycling helps. Recycling reduces the garbage at this end, and it reduces the pressure to mine and harvest new stuff at this end. Yes, 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 we should all recycle. But recycling is not enough. Recycling will never be enough for a couple reasons. First, the waste coming out of our houses is just the tip of the iceberg. For every one garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that one garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems. Also, much of the garbage can't be recycled, either because it contains too many toxics or it's designed not to be recyclable in the first place. Like those juice packs, where they have layers of metal and paper and plastic all smooshed together, you can never separate those for true recycling. So you see, it is a system in crisis. All along the way, we are bumping up against limits. From changing climate to declining happiness, it's just not working. But the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is that there are so many points of intervention. There are people working here on saving forests and here on clean production, people working on labor rights and fair trade and conscious consuming and blocking landfills and incinerators, and very importantly, on taking back our government so that it really is by the people and for the people. All of this work is critically important, but things are really going to start moving when we see the connections, when we see the big picture. When people along this system get united, we can reclaim and transform this linear system into something new, a system that doesn't waste resources or people. Because what we really need to chuck is that old school throwaway mindset. There's a new school of thinking on this stuff, and it's based on sustainability and equity, green chemistry, zero waste, closed loop production, renewable energy, local living economies. It's already happening. Now, some say it's unrealistic. Idealistic that it can't happen, but I say the ones who are unrealistic are those that want to continue with the old path. That's dreaming. Remember, that old way didn't just happen. It's not like gravity that we've just got to live with. People created it, and we're people too. So let's create something new.
Since we've heard about planned obsolescence, let's hear something about the logical consequences of things which are obsolete. This is waste disposal. Especially consider how the incipient waste disposal problem, which was going to be laid at the store of those who actually created the waste, the producers, was shifted to the consumers, became a litter problem and a personal issue due to the careful action of corporations who foresaw this and staved it off by shaping public perception. This is the soundtrack from Heather Rogers' 2005 film, The Hidden Life of Garbage.
Over the last 30 years, our mountains of waste have doubled, despite the much ballyhooed rise in recycling. According to the official ideology, America is getting greener. We reduce, reuse, and recycle.
When I recycle, it makes me feel good because I feel like I'm helping the environment.
I think it's great for the environment. I think it's an important thing.
I feel like I'm actually doing something for the world.
You know, it's a hip thing. It's like having a higher consciousness.
Recycling makes me feel like...
like you've done something.
Yeah, I'm doing my part.
If you do it that day, you're like, yeah.
When you recycle, you don't have to use this, more materials.
Recycling is good for the earth and stuff. I think recycling works.
In reality, recycling isn't so simple. Some materials are more easily recycled than others, some aren't recycled at all, and many recycling processes cause pollution of their own. Take plastic, for example. Only 5% of it gets recycled, and much of that goes into products that cannot in turn be recycled themselves. Each time plastic is reprocessed, its chemical bonds break down. This is called downcycling. And to overcome this, recycled plastic must be mixed with lots of virgin plastic to be of any use. Downcycling also occurs in processing used paper, and eventually, all plastic and paper is incinerated or ends up in a landfill.
at the Ecology Center, we collect all the food containers in one stream of material, then paper in a second stream of material, and it's separated by hand. Once plastic is pulled off, it gets sent to a machine, and we transport the bottles to our baler, which is similar, if you will, analogy, is like a hay baler. And these bottles are coalesced together and squeezed into a cube that weighs about 1,200 pounds. What happens is these bales are broken apart, and they sent through another machine called a granulator, and they get made into granules about the size of a BB. And at that point, that's your raw material from wherever next you send the plastic to. So it's a pretty complicated process.
All this stuff is used for a different thing. It's really weird. Okay, I guess the glass is remade. Remelted down. What happened to this? They melted down and they make a football uniform and jerseys and sweatshirts and stuff. This stuff is valuable. They pay you 42 cents a pound for this stuff. Okay? That's a lot of money.
Plastic is growing at 7 times the rate of plastic recycling, so we're not keeping up.
One of the problems that we face is that plastics recycling has been promoted by a group called the American Plastics Council. And they're also convincing a lot of consumers that all this plastic is actually recyclable. Recycling programs operators like myself have been left literally holding the bag, trying to sell all this plastic or give it away and to what is in essence is a fictional market.
Recycling wasn't always feel-good fraud. Throughout history, people routinely reused materials. In the 19th century, it was big business and a way of life. On Barren Island in Jamaica Bay, where much of New York City's rubbish was dumped, hundreds of people lived and worked among the refuse. Known as scow trimmers and rag pickers, they dug through piles of garbage on the island and on the barges around it. They looked for repairable household items like furniture, dishware, and textiles. They gathered up bones to make soap and fertilizer, rags to make paper, and, with the unidentified dregs left behind, they made imitation coffee and sausage to sell at boarding houses. This intensive reuse of waste continued into the 1940s, when the U.S. government encouraged the public to recycle metal and other materials as part of the war effort. In those days, a single thick glass bottle could be reused up to 40 times. But after the war, everything changed. Mass prosperity brought an explosion of a modern consumer culture based on advertising, image, and the persuasive power of brands and packaging. A new breed of garbage was born.
New. Gleam and only Gleam has the patented GL70 formula to destroy decay bacteria with just one brushing.
Well, what's the difference, as long as you've got Tide?
I want this new Philco because it has adjustable shelves, and my husband likes the price tag.
By the late 50s, producers were spending as much on packaging and advertising as they spent on manufacturing. And, as the boom times wore on, markets became saturated. There was just too much stuff and not enough consumption. The trick was to keep people buying, to get the economy to metabolize more products. The strategy, built-in obsolescence.
Make your trips with baby more fun. Wherever you go, go with Playtex Driper disposable diapers.
Capitalism has an absolute imperative to push more and more things out. You know, the products of today render the products of yesterday obsolete. And that keeps everybody buying. And if people don't buy, then you can't make any money, and then accumulation slows down, and you get a crisis. So you have to keep the commodities flowing. I mean, that's the absolute fundamental rule of capitalism. So there's a natural tendency towards obsolescence of a technological nature, of a fashion nature, of product design nature. There's a number of ways in which the old world will constantly be rendered obsolete. That's another aspect of capitalism's creative destruction. It isn't that it's just tearing down factories or tearing down places, but it's actually tearing down its own products.
As wages rose during the 50s, private waste haulers turned away from labor-intensive reuse and recycling practices. The new dump would use technology, like the compactor truck and the sanitary landfill. Both of these innovations had been developed during World War II by the Army Corps of Engineers, with thousands of troops concentrated together at domestic bases. Managing the mess was a huge project. In fact, the Army drafted Jean Vincennes, the architect of America's first sanitary landfill, to help research methods of compressing and burying mass quantities of trash. As these technologies of war became part of daily life, even freelance scavengers were banned from the dump because they got in the way of the machines.
Once, the land seemed inexhaustible. The whole vast sweep of the American continent, 3 million square miles of the richest land on earth, a land of quiet main streets, rolling farmlands, plains, forests, and mountains. A land with elbow room, with unlimited space for our towns, our cities, and our people to grow.
What you see is on one end, you know, the modern suburb where you could just scrape away the hillsides and pay no attention to terrain. And on the other side, you could take any hole in the ground, any ravine or the edge of the San Francisco Bay, and you could dump your garbage in it, and then you could cover it over with dirt. So that's the modern landfill.
I think the important thing to remember about landfills is that they're not just an unfortunate byproduct of capitalism, they actually represent the success of capitalism. The extent to which profit has been successfully achieved is the extent to which we have more garbage to put in the landfill. What we also need to think about is the amount of labor that went into producing these products, the time that was spent making these products that were specifically designed to wear out faster than they needed to. What else could we have done with that time? What other productive, scientific, creative pursuits could we have invested that time in? What kind of society could we have created alternatively?
American industry, to save production costs, carries on a continual search for ways of keeping costs down to hold prices down, so our products can be priced to stand out in our competitive American market.
The petrochemical revolution around World War II, we started generating a new waste stream that was heavy on plastics, heavy on synthetics, heavy on toxics. And then we discovered that, of course, once you bury it, it's leaching into the water. It's still a danger.
There's a party in every bottle of NoCal. And don't forget, for picnics and beach parties, NoCal also comes in quick-chilling, easy-to-carry cans.
In 1953, not long after disposable cans and bottles were introduced on a mass scale, Vermont's state legislature passed a law that completely banned the sale of throwaway bottles. Within months, the beverage container industry, seeing that Vermont's law would limit their profits, counterattacked. They started a group called Keep America Beautiful and thus invented corporate greenwashing.
So suddenly you get Lady Bird Johnson and others say that the problem is simply one of beauty rather than of potential real danger, hazard, and even a kind of malignant way of living. But you weren't going to tackle that head on, because that would mean you'd have to tackle, you know, the whole basis of consumer society, which is, you know, fundamental to modern capitalist production and to the whole way the United States works.
But while we're a responsible people with regard to our tangible resources of forests and minerals, how do we treat this important resource for recreation? We go away from home on a vacation and take a holiday from responsibility. We launch a fallout of litter. The litter problem seems to get worse. Sadly and ironically, because of scientific advances and new improvements in modern living, trash only becomes trash after it has first served a useful purpose. It becomes litter only after people thoughtlessly discard it.
So then it's about, you know, if you're not going to tackle that, what other device do you have? Well, it's to say, look, at you, the individual, don't be a bad person and throw the litter out the window. So it's an individual responsibility. Do not litter. Be a good citizen.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Keep America Beautiful's campaign worked. Vermont's ban on disposables was undone, and no legislation like it has ever passed again. By the late 1960s, environmental consciousness was on the rise, triggered in part by Rachel Carson's best-selling book, Silent Spring. Though Carson focused on the toxic effects of DDT, her work also helped stimulate a return to recycling and a critique of consumerism in general. Volunteers started neighborhood recycling programs and organized the first Earth Day in 1970, where hippies coined the now ubiquitous term, reduce, reuse, recycle.
When we salvage for reuse and we save something in its already manufactured form, we conserve both the material and the cultural value and the energy that went into producing the object. Now, if the same object is shredded up and bashed and remanufactured into something new, it's good for it to be recycled, but it isn't nearly as good as if that value had been conserved in the first place by reusing the object as is. You have to use all the resources that you've taken out of the wild. You have to use them as long as you can, and you can't just dig a hole in the ground and bury them.
Today, there are over 9,000 curbside recycling programs in the U.S. More Americans recycle than vote. But for all this, the mountains of garbage continue to grow, and industry's role in waste production, to some extent, remains hidden. Consider this. For every ton of household trash, more than 70 tons of waste are produced by industries like manufacturing, mining, agriculture, and petrochemicals.
Capital's only relation to nature is ultimately its relation to accumulation. But the technological power is so great now that that law of accumulation can mean a law of destruction of the Earth and of life on Earth at a scale never before seen. Unless society, human beings, thinking human beings, intervene to say our only relationship to nature cannot just be accumulation and profit. It has to be that we live on this earth, that we do not destroy this earth, that the beautiful things of the earth are maintained. The only way you can do that is to stop capitalism. To say, no, here you may not go. Here you may not dig. Here you may not transform. Here you may not alter your gene pool. Here you may not pollute the atmosphere. Here you may not burn natural fossil fuels. Social regulation is an inherent part, a necessary part of social life under modern production. And if you don't regulate it, the market misbehaves, the companies misbehave, and you can, you know, drown in your own waste.
Some of the media used for this show are LinkedIn from the web address www.unwelcomeguests.net/534. All previous episodes of the show are available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. They'll take your money.